This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
For the third time this season, Manchester City have had to come from behind to get something out of a game. Extend that to the back end of last season, and it's five times in 10 matches. But, crucially, Pep Guardiola's side haven't lost any of them. It was the late show against Borussia Dortmund on Wednesday night, but a pair of brilliant goals completed the turnaround. And now, after a Premier League break, it's back to domestic action. Wolves away is up next, and we'll hear from Dave Azzopardi from Talking Wolves to get an insight into this weekend's opposition. And for the first time in 70 years, City have now played a game with a king on the UK throne. We'll hear from historian Dr. Gary James about how City have fared around the changes of monarchs in the past. Plus, author Simon Curtis will be on the show a bit later on about his new book, City in Europe. All that to come. I'm David Mooney. With me this week for this week's Blue Moon podcast is City fan Paul Atherton.
Dean Moons, you okay?
Not too bad, thank you. And the artist formerly known as the Paris Angel, it's Macca.
Yeah, mate, you all right?
Not too bad, thanks. How are you, Macca? It's been a while.
Yeah, good, yeah. It's been, as we just saw, about 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing's happened in between, has
it? Quiet time, yeah. Yeah. In all that. So let's start with the one game that that went ahead this week in Borussia Dortmund in the Champions League. Paul, for the what feels like 100th time this season, City have won a game that in years gone by they probably wouldn't have won. Are you getting a bit more confidence about the fact that City keep being able to turn around these leads or these deficits? Or are you starting to think they can't get away with it forever?
Well, they can't get away with it forever. I mean, the amount of times we've gone down recently and somehow we've come back and it's miraculous recovery. It's brilliant, but you can't keep relying on that. I think you are right that years ago we would have had to play at our absolute best to have a chance against a team like Dortmund. And in this case, we weren't at our best. Thankfully, we conceded with enough time to try and recover the performance because I think that was the best result, really, because we got the win. We've underperformed 60, 70 minutes. That there's enough like harsh lessons coming out of it for the team, and I'm sure the manager's passed it on. But then we still got a good result out the end of it, and we still got a good sort of momentum because we did recover it and we did sort of step it up towards the end. But yeah, I mean, it was a strange one, really.
Macca, where do you think this ability to play badly and then suddenly play well for the last 10 minutes and win the game has come from?
Well, last night in particular, I mean, it's always obviously on a game by game basis, but I mean last night obviously the substitutions were spot on, and then just never underestimate the influence of Haaland, because he's just, I mean, I just think he's absolutely incredible. I mean, I know everyone's talking about him and about how good he is, but even when he's not doing something, he's doing something, if that makes sense.
Even when he's not touching the ball, he's doing something.
Yeah, I mean, everything is just kind of, it's like an art. It's just, everything was for that last moment. He's got people, he looks like he's making just jogging things, but he's always tiring people out. And I mean, I know as a team as a whole, that's what we do. We will wear them out. But him in particular, it's just everything for a reason, it seems. I mean, so going back to your question, I think don't underestimate his influence for a start. And then I'm actually fairly relaxed about the us digging ourselves out of these holes late on, because you'll get teams who, they want to stop us playing, but then if they see other games where other teams have tried to stop us playing, it gets to 85 minutes, they're knackered, and then we still score. So they might actually think, well, hang on a minute. Is it actually worth doing that? Because they're going to score anyway. So do we go a little bit earlier? But then you've got the situation like with West Ham, where the first time they actually tried anything positive, within minutes, we'd scored because they'd left gaps. So I'm fairly... I know last night it was slow. It was a bit lethargic. Things weren't working on the flanks. But I've turned into this really boring person who just actually just looks at it and just like, I'm actually quite relaxed about this. I trusted the manager, I trusted the process, in inverted commas. But then, and then, and And then I like the player, I like all the players. And it's like, it's a very weird experience for me. Because it's not how I've watched City all over these years. And like I say, I was fairly relaxed.
It makes a change from having to go back to the 90s and not liking the players, isn't it?
It's, I despised every single one of them back in Gladsey. But
Paul, the changes that Macca talks about there, I mean, Guardiola made a triple substitution, which I get that it's different now that there are that he's got five subs available to him, but it was a bold move. Bernardo, Foden and Alvarez all on completely changed the tempo of the game, didn't it?
Completely. I mean, it was a change between doing the same thing every time the ball got out wide to having more energy, more lack of predictability with players moving in and out, not necessarily just sticking on the wing, but then also having the width for Foden on his left foot on the left, and then De Bruyne being pushed out on the right on his right foot, getting crosses in. And they just made so much difference. It made the game wider. It stretched the Dortmund defence a lot more. It was, as Macca said, it was the substitutions that made that difference. Substitutions then probably impetus that we needed that goal almost to kick us on. I think if we didn't concede, I don't think we would have stepped up the performance in the way that we did.
Yeah, I do wonder if Guardiola was going to do a three-way change. If he was already getting Alvarez ready to come on, and I wonder if the fact that Dortmund scored pretty much straight away at that point then made his mind up to say, look, the tempo just needs to change. And like, as you say, Paul, it was just really slow, wasn't it?
It was. It was just the same moves every time. And it's one of those things where you want to rotate for the Premier League team, get Mahrez and Grealish into the get their season started almost. And again, for both of them, it hasn't, through injuries and through form. And it's just, you need those games to go well, and you've got a good story coming out of it that one of them's come out and they scored a goal and they're going to kick on and start getting back into the first team. But it just doesn't happen sometimes. And then you're reliant on your Premier League first team coming in and changing the game. So that was the disappointment, I thought, coming from it. But I think Dortmund played a really good game against them, and we're just far too narrow because of the way we're set up.
Yeah, let's talk about the setup a little bit, Macca, because there's people who will routinely ask questions to the podcast, both here and the one I do with The Athletic, Why Always Us, about the fact that Guardiola loves to play these inverted wingers. He loves a right footer on the left and a left footer on the right in Grealish and Mahrez. Is that a problem when you've got a right footer in Cancelo often having to play left back behind him, and then a fullback who is a centre back in John Stones playing behind the other one? Does that just make the pitch too narrow?
Yeah, possibly does. I mean, last night, I mean, taking away before going on to the fullbacks, I mean, they were just going into like Paul just said, it was just kind of they were running into traffic, then it was just start again. But it just didn't work. I wouldn't say in general that it's time to kind of like just forget about inverted wing because it's not working. But last night was a prime example when it doesn't work, because they're running into traffic. All the pass lines are actually blocked off. They were really well organised, and it simply didn't work. I do understand that with Cancelo. I think that's a very good point. He's hardly going to go on the overlap, is he, hairing down, because he's not really trusting his left foot too much.
Doesn't need a left foot, though, does he, with the quality of the outside of his right foot?
And he's weird, Cancelo, because he is better at left back in terms of not his defending, because I have an issue with his defending at left back, but that's not what he's there for. He's much, much better at left back as a creative player, which is what he's there for, than he is at right back. So I've no problem with him being there. But no, it's a very valid point about him being behind Grealish. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't particularly worried about Grealish last year. But I mean, he does need to start doing a little bit more. And like I say, I'm not massively worried this year either. But he does need to start doing a bit, I think.
Yeah, Paul, are you quite relaxed about Grealish, or is it again like Macca? Is it the fact that the second season's here now? It's time to kind of kick on.
I'm quite relaxed as a squad player, but I think for the sort of price tag and what we've bought him for, I am a bit concerned, because he's only really played on that left wing when he played like the number nine, false nine, whatever it is. He was quite poor, I think, last year when he played there one or two times.
That price tag's really, it's going to hang around his neck, isn't it?
It is because you know, Mahrez over the last two, three seasons has been amongst our top scorers and he's turned it on at the key times. Sterling, you know, would have some poor games, but he would always score a lot of goals when he played. Jesus would when he came on. So it's kind of, you judge Grealish by his stats almost, because you've got enough possession players in the team that, you know, is he creating enough? Is he scoring enough? And that hasn't happened yet. And he was injured quite a lot last team. It was hard. We had quite of an established 11. It was hard for him to break into. Foden, obviously, he was almost trying to replace on that left. But, you know, as time goes on, you want to see a bit more from him. So I think he's always going to fit into the team and do well and retain possession. And he'll chip in every so often. But it's, you know, to take up one of the three most attacking parts of the City team, you need to be like, you know, an almost guaranteed assist per game sort of ratio, and he's not delivering that at the moment.
Yeah, Macca, do you have any issues with kind of? It's clear Mahrez is out of form at the moment, and he's really struggled at the start of this season. Like, is this a problem at the moment, or is it just something that he needs to play through?
I've no problem with Mahrez. I mean, he's shown how good he is. And yeah, I'd like to say it's just one of those. It's a confidence thing. I think I get the impression he wants to be one of the kind of the big men who's playing all the time, and he's not. So that's probably been a bit of a hit to his ego and everything like that. And people go through runs of form where they're not as good as they possibly can be. So no, I've no problem with that. But just going back to Grealish. But there is also a possibility that that's not his position.
Yeah,
that they need to just say, well, maybe try him centrally when you can. I know there's not a lot of options all the time or opportunities all the time in our strongest side, but he was the main man at Villa, and I think he's a good enough footballer. And it is a difficult position to try and get your head around if you've not done it all your life. I mean, he's not a kid. I mean, he's 27, 28.
Don't know. Sounds like a kid though to me, Macca.
No. But what I mean is he's played a lot of football and not always in that position. So if he's not good there, it might just not be his position.
It's that position in the Pep team as well, isn't it? It's like you don't leave that touch line because we need to create width rather than roam. It's a lot of concentration, and you know, as a right footer on there, there's only so much you can do at times.
Yeah, no, totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in fairness to him, though, Paul, he was. He made a couple of things happen in that first half. He looked like the player that would make something happen for City in that first half, albeit, you know, he didn't play very well and the team didn't play very well. And I think the two shots he had were blocked. But, like, he was in the position to get something, if you know what I mean. Does that count for anything?
It does, because he's getting there. But then it's like Sterling was getting the right places and he missed a few, but he'd score a lot. Whereas with Grealish, if it over a protracted period, he's just getting there, then scuffing it. And I don't know, you've got to, for that level of ability in that team, you need to be taking them.
Yeah.
It's like every time you know, Haaland's obviously an exception, but every time he gets it, he seems to be taking his opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's talk about those taken opportunities, because we're over 10 minutes in and we've not mentioned two of the greatest goals that have happened for City in the Champions League. I really like this stat, Macca. That was John Stones' 13th City goal and right. Erling Haaland's 13th City goal.
Okay.
Thanks to Stat City for finding that one. But I just like the contrast of that.
No, it's got, I mean Stones' was brilliant. I mean, I love John Stones anyway. He's just great. I mean, he's not a right back, but he did all right. But that was just a fantastic goal. Haaland's, so I'm in the south stand, obviously at the opposite end. I didn't realise how good that goal was until I got home and watched it on telly.
Yeah.
Because I just thought he just stuck a leg out. I didn't appreciate how good Cancelo's ball was either. I mean, both of them were things of beauty. But, I mean, that goal, it's just unreal. Like, I said exactly the thing I think you said about what Paul Dicko said. I couldn't even get my head that high.
Yeah. I was just about to I was just about to drop that name in there. Then I was going to you've stolen my thunder. I was going to say Paul. The name drop I have is that Paul Dicko said in a WhatsApp group that I'm in that he can't even get his head that high, and I completely forgot. Mackie, you must. I think you're about the same height as him, aren't you?
Yeah, similar.
Yeah, but like honestly, Paul, when De Bruyne had sent that bouncing ball to John Stones and he shaped up to hit it, were you like, "What the hell are you doing?"
I don't know. I feel like he was so unblocked, and he, you know, he's quite a good technical player. He doesn't often shoot, does he, John Stones? It's usually a tapping or a header.
13 goals since 2016 kind of says why.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like he was so open. And it was the right pace, and we'd been trying all sorts, and it wasn't working. You know, it's like the company versus Leicester. Sometimes if you like, you know, within 20 yards of the goal, just hit it. Sometimes, so yeah.
So now that I've just made you say that, can you explain to me why you never take the shot on?
I prefer to dribble it past the keeper a couple of times first, and then hit it wide.
Yeah, I've played in enough teams with you to see that every time the shot's on, you just turn it down for some reason. Maka, I'm going to make you decide now. The Cancelo assist or the Haaland finish, which was better?
Ooh. You know what? I'm going to go for the Cancelo assist, because without that, you wouldn't have had the finish.
Yeah, fair point. I put it to you though, Paul, that Cancelo probably does that all the time with the outside of his foot, because he just does not use his left. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the pass is unbelievable. I think because Cancelo does it all the time, I'm probably kind of playing it down because, you know, he hit it in the area. It wasn't exactly on Haaland's head, was it? You know, he had to get his left foot behind. I can't even describe how that actually transpired, that goal. But he had to kind of... Only Haaland is probably the only player with that range or ability to get his foot up there and to do it and to redirect it. Because all he knew was, I have to get my foot up there, let it hit my foot, and get it on target, and there's a good chance it's going in. It's just the genius of having that level of striker with that range. You know, that's going over. You could stack two Agueros on top of each other, and he wasn't going to get near that ball, was he?
So. Yeah.
Ruth, my wife, asked how he did it this morning, like, because she'd not seen it on telly. So she asked this morning how it was, and I tried to do it, and never did myself a serious mistake.
Yeah. Sorry,
I'll be 5'4" and not 6'4".
Yeah. Did you rip your pants as you did it?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I'm still distracted by this image of two Agueros stood on top of each other. I'm just like you know, like wearing a really long duffel coat.
Yeah. trying to get in a club.
Just one stood on the other's shoulders to see what was going on. Yeah.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
The majority of fans, Wednesday's game against Dortmund was the first time that City have played with a king on the throne of the United Kingdom. I've been speaking to the football historian Dr. Gary James to find out more about City and the monarchy.
I mean, the last time we played a league game under a king was... Well, obviously 70 years ago, it's 1952. I checked up on it actually to see where it was before, because I was thinking, oh, I wonder where it was. And it was a 2-2 draw with Arsenal in January 52. And it's sort of, I mean, obviously there are people, you know, my dad's in his 80s, he was around then, you know, there are people around. But for most of us, it's just such an unusual thing, isn't it? It's such a rare occurrence in our eyes. Whereas I guess in the 50s, when the Queen came to the throne, people were probably thinking, oh, it's extremely rare for a Queen to be on the throne. It's usually a king, you know.
Well, this is it. I mean, it's around about 60% of City's games have been played under a Queen. But the vast majority of them are Elizabeth. It was about 54% for Elizabeth, because Victoria was only on the throne until 1901. City, of course, you know, founded in 1894.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously we didn't... Well, I was going to say we didn't win any trophies, but we did. We won the second division title under Victoria. So I suppose our first national success came under Victoria. But, yeah, we didn't win what would today be regarded as a major trophy under Victoria. And you sort of think, you know, for the people, you know, when she died in 1901, the sort of City fans who were around then, many of those would have only known a Queen because, you know, she was certainly on the throne before football, professional football existed. And she'd probably been on the throne for, again, like now, you know, it was so many decades that the vast majority of people probably hadn't known a king. So it was a strange experience. But do you know, and this is one of the things, I don't know if I'm jumping the gun here, but there's been the furore about do we play on, do we not play, and so on. And every time there's been a change of monarch, City have carried on, City have played on. I mean, obviously, there may be days where of clash with funerals, where games have been postponed or rearranged, and so on. And you know, I'm thinking about when Diana died, actually, and obviously she wasn't a monarch, but when Diana died, games were postponed from the funeral, the day of the funeral.
Yeah.
But in terms of the sort of first games after a senior member of the royal family have died, they've not been postponed in the past. Very unusual. When Victoria died, there was a view that games should be postponed, and the FA eventually the FA said something like football should be stopped. The Football League protested, saying, hey, we're all going to lose some money. We can't do that. We've got to play on.
God, that message hasn't changed in years, has it?
Yeah, and actually City were one of the teams that played on. There's a couple of the sort of London-based teams or Southern teams that didn't play on, but certainly City played on even after Victoria died. So it's very unusual how it's gone recently.
Yeah, and obviously just looking then at kind of like major trophies and things, City's first major trophy came under a king. It was Edward VII who took over from Victoria. It's only 3 years after that moniker changed. So maybe that's a good sign for Charles III.
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe. And, you know, I think Edward VII, he died just in the close season as well. So there's no question about games being postponed. But for us to win the FA Cup and finish runners-up in the league, which, of course, was the most significant league position we'd finish, is a big statement, really. But, I suppose, you know, there may have been some City fans going around saying, that's it, you know, under King, we're going to be all right now.
Yeah, just doing the rough maths in my head, it must be under a Queen where they've won the most major trophies, because all of the current eras obviously come under Elizabeth, and the 60s was as well.
Yeah, I had a look at this actually, and we've won, I think it's 20 major trophies, including our only European trophy at the moment. But that's what, a trophy every sort of 3.5 years, something like that. So under Elizabeth, it's obviously by far the best ratio. But of course, we all know that the 70 years of her reign has been ups and downs, and we've dropped our lowest point as well. So it is a bit difficult to sort of do a direct comparison. But the best one, I suppose, the best sort of transition would be when the Queen's dad came to the throne, because his brother abdicated in 1936. And so the Queen's dad came to the throne in December 36. That went on to be our first title-winning season. And there was a definite transformation of the club. I mean, we lost a couple of the first sort of three or four games under his sort of reign, if you like. But the rest of the season, we were, you know, it was our longest unbeaten run, which has since been beaten, but at the time it was our longest unbeaten run, and we go and win our first league title. And his coronation happened at the end of the football season, and City went on tour to Germany. But, you know, Manchester was sort of decorated in red, white and blue and the Union Jack and all this sort of stuff. And I guess there was some City fans thinking, oh, yeah, that's for our league title success.
Yeah, not quite the case. One stat that I dug up. This was a few years ago. So this was during Elizabeth's reign. Was that there've been since City were founded in 1894? There were more monarchs on the UK throne than there were seasons where City won home and away against Liverpool. at the time, there was six monarchs and five seasons. It's now seven monarchs and five seasons. So we could do a change of that one sometime soon, because we don't want the monarchs getting too far ahead.
Oh God, no, we definitely need that one changing. I mean, but do you know what? I mean, you could have probably done a snapshot. I don't know, say for the Queen's granddad, which would have said actually it was the reverse of that. But I don't want to check that one just in case I'm wrong. But you never know. But I suppose there's a couple of other things we should say about the royals, which have just come to me actually. King George V, who, you know, we won the FA Cup in 1934 when he was on the throne, and that's the Queen's granddad. And we got to two cup finals and we finished second in the league and stuff like that. But he also came to Hyde Road in 1920 when he was the king. So, you know, a reigning monarch coming to Hyde Road. So, you know, in some ways that's a different angle. And also the Queen's dad, when he was still a prince, when he was still the Duke of York, he went to Main Road and watched a game. I think it was Derby County, actually, off the top of my head. But he went to Main Road to watch a game, just an ordinary league game as well. Nothing, you know, there's nothing special about it. He just went to an ordinary league game, same as King George V had as well. So, you know, when you think about that, there's a few extra royal connections that I think we should remember, really. So the last king prior to Charles and his father have both been to home league games for City.
Get a dollop of City nostalgia every Monday. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Gary James speaking to me. And again, thanks to Stat City, we've dug out some stats about City's performances, because I did wonder about kings and queens on the throne with regards to City. And the win percentage is actually pretty similar. 45% under queens, 43% under kings. However, they've played two-thirds of their games with a queen on the throne. So it's Elizabeth mainly and Victoria for the first few years of their existence. So yeah, make that what you will. A couple of other things before we move on. Paul, are you a fan of Phil Foden's haircut photos? Would you, you know, back the squad number being shaved into the side of your head?
Probably not. No, I don't think it's not for me. I don't think I could pull it off. I think he can.
You're not going to say I'd just get. You're not going to say a six in the side of your head.
No, it's not going to happen. No. Yeah. You? Would you do it?
Well, I mean, I goalkeeper, so I'll have number one, which just would just look ridiculous. It'd look like I'm boasting everywhere I went, really, wouldn't it? So.
Numero uno.
Yeah.
that's you sort of that's your strange ways number, is it? Something like that.
Yeah. I'd have to play. I'd have to start playing number 13 or something like that, to get the full effect. But yeah. And Macca, the final thing for the Dortmund game, I did love. Guardiola being booked and then hugging the referee, it kind of feels like that sort of mood that all parents know of, like the naughty child trying to get back in the good books.
Yeah, it was very funny, that. Very funny.
It's so funny to watch, isn't it? Just watching that transpire, like, I literally have no idea what's going on.
Well, can you imagine living with him?
Yeah.
It must be that absolute nightmare. I know, obviously, I love him to bits, but he just, oh.
He's got a
down,
sense of humour. That's the thing that gets him out of it. He just kind of, he knows what he's doing, doesn't he? That's why he laughs and did the hug. But he also knows he's very, very intense.
Yes, yeah. Incredibly intense. But yeah, no, I'm not sure I could spend much more than a week with him.
Yeah, you imagine you'd kind of like roll over in the night, wouldn't you? If you were married to him, you'd roll over in the night and he wouldn't be there. And you're like, where is he now? Yeah, the bathroom light would be on and just be like stood in the bathroom doodling like on his notepad because he got up to like. Get something out of his teeth or something, and then he had an idea.
He'd have one of them London basements with like an office, wouldn't he? And the study lamp would be on. He'd just be,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. With a quill.
Yeah. Yeah, like Pep Guardiola, the private investigator sort of look. Yeah, right. Well, it's time to look ahead to this weekend's trip to Wolves. Let's start by hearing from Dave Azzopardi from Talking Wolves. I've been speaking to him to find out more about their start to the season, and I asked whether it's been going in a similar sort of way to last season.
Yeah, similar sort of thing, really. Where, you know. As of right now, we've got the best defence in the Premier League again on paper at the moment. You know, we haven't faced off against many tough teams. I think City now will be the best team that we've faced, other than Spurs, I would say, in that sort of top six bracket. But yeah, but it's the same issues as last season, really. Where defensively, yes, we're fine, but we're still struggling to score the goals down the other end of the pitch. So once again, I think, yes, we've got the best defence in the league, but we're also the lowest scorers in the league as well. The teams that we've played, such as Bournemouth, who just lost, you know, 9-0 to Liverpool, you almost think it's a perfect time to play them. And then we go to their place and it's a goalless draw. So that's something that Wolves need to address a little bit more. Obviously, we're in the market for a forward. We're trying to bolster that front line, and hopefully the goals will start to come sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Is it chance creation or is it finishing? What's the problem?
It's probably a little bit of both. Again, there's some games. I'll bring up the game against Tottenham again, where we had 20 shots on goal, which you look at that and you think, oh, Wolves had a lot of chances, but I think our XG was like below one. So that says, you know, the quality of the chances. So I think it's probably more chance creation than anything, to be honest. It's not like we're missing many clear-cut opportunities. But we're just trying to find, it's almost trying to get that ball from the midfield, the attacking midfield areas into those, you know, to create the clear cut chances, just missing that final ball. Wolves are really at the minute.
Yeah. How's it been at Molineux? Because obviously if this game goes ahead, then it will be at Molineux. We were kind of hoping that Liverpool might have softened you up a bit first, but obviously that went in the can this weekend.
Yeah, it's not been too bad so far. I think, you know, we'd had a pretty poor start to the season in regards to results. And I think our last game against Southampton at Molineux was almost a must win, really, because if we didn't beat Southampton, we would have come up against, obviously, Liverpool, you guys. After the international break, we play West Ham and then Chelsea, which obviously both aren't easy games. So Bruno Lage could have so easily gone in 8-9 games into the season without a win. So that win against Southampton was huge, and the atmosphere was good at Molineux as well. We were disappointed with the draw against Bournemouth, and I think everyone almost knew in the back of their minds, like, we've got to get behind the team, we've got to get behind the manager here to try and get a result, and that's exactly what we got. So it's given us a little bit more time. We've got a couple of new signings that came in late in the deadline, so a bit more time for them to get match fit, match sharp, integrate with the team a little bit more. So, you know, I was gutted that the game against Liverpool didn't go ahead, but, you know, it's just given us that little bit more time to prepare ahead of this fixture on Saturday.
Yeah, let's talk about the transfer window, because, as you say, there's been a few players come in towards the end of the window. What do you make of it all? How do you think you've done this summer?
I think it was a good window for Wolves. It took a little bit longer than fans would have wanted. You know, fans started to get a little bit impatient. The manager said at the end of last season that he wanted to have the core of his squad ready at the start of pre-season, and we'd only just signed one player and we'd lost quite a few. And it's almost a fresh team. You know, we've seen a lot of established players gone that we'd had. Romain Saiss had been at the club a long time and he left on a free. Connor Cody was, of course, a big shock to a lot of people, but it made sense for the direction that Wolves want to go in. So it's a big change for Wolves, but we've brought in some quality players. I think, you know, Nathan Collins, who is a young, very talented defender and started off brilliantly, like I said earlier, with those defensive stats. Gonzalo Guedes, who's a player that's played sort of top end of Spanish football for a long time. Mateus Nunes, who's a player that even Pep Guardiola sort of praised previously as well. And just strengthened all around the team, really. We'd signed a new striker, Sasha Kalajdzic, 6'7" forward from Stuttgart, but unfortunately he's done his ACL already on his debut. So now we're in the market and we're set to sign Diego Costa. So again, an interesting one. I think he's probably going to be in the squad for that game against City as well.
I was going to ask how close that was. Is it looking likely to get through before Saturday?
It's pretty much a done deal. I think, obviously, with what's been going on this weekend, I think the Wolves have found it difficult to with the timing of announcing the signing. But yeah, it's pretty much done. So I think, again, that's one of the advantages, I suppose, of not having a game. It's given us, you know, an extra week to get him match fit, try and get him, you know, up to sort of a match ready status, really. So, but I think he'll be in the squad. He might not start on Saturday, but he'll definitely be in the squad.
Yeah, well, we all know the damage that Costa can do in the Premier League. If you are going to get a result against City, who are the players that'll do it this weekend?
I think through the midfield, Neves, of course. You know, we're so lucky to have kept him. He's just been making things tick. And the new signing, Mateus Nunes, as well. And he grabbed himself an assist last weekend. But just bringing the ball forward, his ball retention. He's almost probably a little bit like De Bruyne sometimes. You can get two or three defenders around him and he still somehow sort of wriggles his way out of trouble. He's a little bit like that, really. And he's been starting a lot of our counter-attacks off. It's just, one of the things with the attackers are, you know, they're doing a lot of the hard work, but it's just not clicking for them. Pedro Neto, who was linked with a move away this summer as well. he's almost making things a little bit too hard for himself. But on his day, you know, he's getting the ball. He could drive forward, make life very difficult for defenders. So it's just, he's one of those players I'm just expecting it to click for soon. So I think it's going to be that midfield battle, though, really. We'll probably play midfield for him, Matinho, Neves and Nunes. And that's where we've got to get most of our joy from, both defensively and going forward.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we spoke ahead of the game at Molineux last season. That turned out to be a lot more comfortable for City than I was expecting in the end. Because as we've said on many of these shows before, Wolves always tend to give City quite a good game these days. How's confidence in going into this one? How are the fans feeling?
It's strange, really. I don't think, you know, no one's expecting us to go over there and sort of, you know, host you guys and beat you on Saturday. I think it's weird because of the Liverpool game. We were sort of looking forward to that because they'd had a bit of a sticky run of form. So there hasn't really been much talk ahead of this game as of yet. But I think when it sinks in and we're playing against you guys are the best team in the country. I think people will start to talk about it a little bit more. But, you know, I think everyone's worried about the likes of Haaland, and we all knew how good he was, but I don't think anybody expected him to sort of kick off as well as he has done. So it's always going to be a worry, but I've seen, you know, I saw the game against Villa. I think there are ways to try and almost frustrate City and stop City. But it is obviously going to be a really tough game. And I think the Wolves fans know that as well. That's why our win against Southampton last weekend was so important.
Yeah, one of the things I've worried about with City this season, it seems to have kind of faded in the last couple of weeks, but it has been kind of momentum shifts in games. Sometimes when the opposition get the tails up for a bit, that's when City can come under pressure. How are you guys kind of dealing with that at the moment? I mean, I watched your game against Spurs. You've mentioned it a couple of times, and I remember thinking, if Wolves don't score soon, they're going to pay for this. And that's exactly how it ended up turning out.
Yeah. That I've used that example a couple of times over the last couple of weeks, to be honest, where I think everyone who watched that game, you know, first half, Wolves were by far the better team. But against anybody, you know, in particular the top six, if you're not going to take your opportunities or not going to create a clear-cut opportunity and take advantage of your dominance, then they're going to punish you. And that's exactly what Spurs did. You know, we made one mistake defensively and they took advantage and scored. So that's the one thing for Wolves. And that's been against every team. You know, there's been games where we've had really good spells of possession. We retain the ball really well, but we're just not threatening enough in front of goal. So that'll be a similar sort of thing I expect on Saturday. You know, City are so good on the ball, but I think Wolves will have their own spells of possession. It's just whether Wolves can be ruthless enough in front of goal, which at the moment they're not. So City take advantage of one Wolves mistake, and I think you'll be in business. So it's going to be interesting to see how Bruno Lage lines up and how we get on Saturday.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Where are you weakest this season? What's been the biggest weaknesses?
There's not, I mean, the biggest weakness is, like I said, us not scoring the goals. But for the areas for City to target, it's probably almost, I think we will play counter-attacking football, obviously, on Saturday, but it's almost City countering that counter. You know, if our fullbacks push forward, I think you'll have a lot of space down those wide areas. I've been pleasantly surprised with how we've gone, because we've shifted from a back five to a back four this season. And I thought there were going to be many, many teething issues, and there haven't been, to be honest. So defensively, you know, the shape and so on has been all right. But I think with the pace, with the talent that City have got, the ability to just pick out a pass I think the fullbacks who have had really good spells this season, but have had really bad spells as well. I think that's where you'll get your joy, I think, down those wide areas.
I want to talk a little bit about Bruno Lage as well, because I work with a couple of Wolves fans, and one of them is absolutely dead against changing the manager. The other one's thinking, now might not be the worst time to change the manager if things don't pick up anytime soon. Is the fan base a little bit split down kind of the job that he's doing at the moment?
Yeah, there was, especially before that game against Southampton, I think there were fans that were saying, you know, after the Bournemouth game, or if we didn't beat Southampton, they would have wanted him to go. He's still a very young manager. We saw it last season. We had a really strong start to the season, but there were still certain areas of his game as a manager where you think, what on earth is he doing? Mainly substitutions, timing of these substitutions and so on. So it is pretty split still. I think, you know, a lot of that calmed down and quieted down after that win against Southampton. But it's one of those things. I think a manager he's always, you know, you're not going to please everyone. Not 100% of the fan base is always going to be happy with the manager. But for me at the moment, I don't think there's many managers out there realistically that are going to come in and do a much better job than what Bruno Lage is doing right now. So I'm happy with him for the time being. You know, things can change quite quickly in football. He's got a tough running coming up. But yeah, for me at the moment, I'm happy with his ideas. I'm happy with the direction he's going in. But the board have almost put the pressure back on him now. Last year, he did an okay job, had no backing. All of a sudden this summer, he's had a load of money chucked at him. He's changed system to suit what he wants to play. So, you know, the ball's in his court now to try and get it right for Wolves this season.
Yeah, and what do you think the ambition should be for Wolves this season? What do you think you can achieve?
I mean, I think the squad is more than capable of a solid top half finish, and even, you know, knocking on the door for top seven again. You know, first 2 years back in the Premier League, that's exactly what we did. We've had a couple of seasons now where we've been disappointing. Last season, you know, we were so close. And I think we had a couple of games against Arsenal in quick succession, which just killed our momentum, and we ended up sliding down the table. So I think we're more than capable to be, you know, knocking around there again. If we can finish sort of 8th or 9th this year, I'd be more than happy. Try and keep hold of the talented players that we've got and make a real push of it next year.
Yeah, and I mean, there is talk that this game might not go ahead. We'll find out a bit later on. If it does, what's your score prediction for it? We'll whack it on the charity bet.
Whenever I come on here, I normally back Wolves, but you know what? Yeah, go on. I'll say a 1-1 draw. That's using my heart. I think my head says probably 2-0 City, but I'll use my heart and go Wolves 1-1.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast, and we're very sorry about that.
So that was Dave Azzopardi from Talking Wolves. Maka, last season's trip to Molineux, I had down as a really tough one, and then Kevin De Bruyne popped up and just decided to score 4 in like an hour or so. So apart from that game, City have always, certainly under Guardiola, found Wolves quite a tricky nut to crack. What would you like to see this weekend to make sure that they don't end up with a repeat of the first 70, 80 minutes against Dortmund?
In terms of, well, you're definitely right. So, I mean, the first game at our place last year, I bumped into Sam Lee before the game, and just we were just chatting, and he went, you know, this is going to be awful. I went, what do you mean? He just said, this is going to be tough. This is going to be really tough. And it was. It was really, really tough. And we were very lucky that game. I mean, it wasn't a penalty, was it, in a million years? And
you mean that ball that didn't touch his hand?
Yeah, that one. So we were very lucky that game. They were very well organised, very hardworking. And like you, I was very surprised, but the result at their place. In terms of what would I want to see, I want to see Foden starting. I want to see Bernardo starting.
Yeah. Paul, is it about kind of more energy in the team? And I know a 12:30 kickoff on a Saturday doesn't scream energy, but you kind of want a bit more impetus to start with, don't you?
I think so. I think after that performance in particular, the strange thing about the previous performance was more because the game of the weekend was cancelled. So they looked tired and slow. So I think they just need to pick up where they were, you know, at the start of the season. Move the ball fast, move the ball quick, get teams out of place and sort of get back into that form. I feel like we haven't got fully back in our rhythm yet of last year. So, you know, fast performance and a good performance would be good to see.
Sorry, but I mean, I don't know about you two. I mean, but every team sheet that I see when Foden's not on the team sheet. I just think, ugh. I'm just relieved. He's one of the first, I know obviously as good as De Bruyne is, I just think Foden just adds so much. So much. And he just rarely has a bad game. And he's just, technically he's obviously brilliant. He works hard. I mean, like I say, every time I don't see him on the team sheet, like last night, I was like, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
So I think a spot on is, it's one of them where, you know, the amount of goals he was scoring the season before, when he's kind of, you know, that was when he really rose and kind of came through. And then the next season, he didn't kind of like hit those dizzy heights stat-wise, but he was always there and always consistent and a strong performer. And he, like I said, he didn't have a bad game. And you do notice him so much when he's out there. It's his energy, and he can go between the lines, he can pass, he can stay wide, he can go in between, and he can score and assist. He's just, you know, all-round strong player, and he doesn't get fazed by the big games either, or the when we need to sort of pull it back.
Well, he knows nothing different. That's the thing. That's the beauty of introducing young lads, same with Cole Palmer now. Like in the past, you have to be really careful and introduce. We might have a decent player on our hands here, but we can't throw him in because it could ruin him, because the crowd could ruin him. No, it's true, though.
Yeah, I'm just laughing about the good old days. That's all. Yeah.
So, but now, actually, they know no different. Phil Foden knows no different. So he must just think he can run through a brick wall. Same with Cole Palmer. Get me on.
Yeah,
I'm better than Grealish. That's what they're probably thinking.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I used to see team sheets in about 2017, 2018 without Sterling on, and thought it'd be a tough game today, not because he's the one that's making us tick. And I wonder if it's the same with Foden. Like as you say, as good as De Bruyne is, and as frequently as De Bruyne puts in that moment of quality that changes a game. Foden could be the key to maybe more like the tempo that City play with rather than just the quality on the ball.
Totally.
Just in terms of Saturday, Maka, most teams play a counter-attacking style against City. So like nobody will be surprised to see Wolves do the same sort of thing. How do you feel City have been in dealing with the counter-attacking sides this season and kind of breaking them down? Because it feels like, they're maybe not. It feels like maybe the moments where they're not very good are a lot lower than they were in previous years. But the moments where they're really good are possibly higher than they were.
Well, I think, I mean, and this comes on to what happened last night, really. I mean, patience as well. You've obviously got to be patient. If teams are sitting back and the crowd in it, and it is very, very difficult. But I think, and I suspect Guardiola will hate this, will be very reluctant to instruct his players to do it. But I think there are times now, given we've got Haaland in the middle, I'm not talking about like long, straight balls, but get it wide, get it in a box. And we didn't do that enough last night. And just try and cause a bit of chaos, but the word chaos probably makes him switch. He doesn't like that. Yeah. That's not what he wants. He wants everything to be just orderly in it, but yeah, I mean what more can you do than if the team is sitting back like that, then get it out wide and get it in the box.
Yeah.
You can't try and play it through the middle through all the traffic and everything. And so yeah, that's the only thing really I would say.
Yeah. I don't know about you, Paul, but I'd quite like to see City tried it a few times in like Edison's first and second season. Because he's got this ridiculous kick. Yeah. I would like to see Haaland go and stand on the penalty spot when it's a City goal kick, because then the opposition have got a decision to make. Either they push up and try and squeeze City and stop them playing out from the back, or they drop deep to cover Haaland. Because, I mean, frankly, surely Edison can hit him from a goal kick on the penalty spot and you can't be offside.
Is this your sort of coaching badges coming into effect here?
This is my idealistic kind of let's cause a bit of mayhem going in there,
because Northern Conference.
Yeah, I mean you've played with me enough times to know that the number of times when I will boot the ball long and then go, yeah, no, I meant that, and it was just dropped really fortunately on somebody's toe. Edison can do it properly. Yeah,
that is our tactic, but that's because we're too tired from running around to play it out. Yeah, well, I think you know, if you do that, it's almost a 50-50% chance, you know, between Haaland and the defender, and he's taller, but you know, but
he's gonna win it, surely.
That's the thing, it's what Mac was saying, is that Pep wants percentages game. If you control possession, generally you're gonna win the game, or your odds are gonna win the game. If you just hoof it up, you're kind of giving away possession more, and you're playing sort of smaller percentage chances.
Yeah, is me turning one of the most technically good teams in the world ever into a route one long ball hoof it
twice a season, catch people off guard. I think that could work, but
yeah. I was going to say I'm not sure it's going to work every week, Dave.
Paul, looking at Wolves, I am nervous about this game at weekend, largely because Wolves have the best defence in the Premier League so far this season. Okay, it's only six games or so, but they've conceded the fewest and they have the worst attack. They've scored the least, which to me screams this game could be really boring.
Could be. I don't expect really. I feel like they're going to dig in, but... You know, Dortmund did it really well for 60, 70 minutes. So,
Wolves aren't Dortmund, I get that, yeah.
They're not, and I think that's what I'm thinking of. And City can't really play much worse than they did in terms of, you know, attacking and incisiveness than they did against Dortmund. So, yeah, I feel like it's going to be a step above. And I don't know how much you could read into six games as well, really, in terms of Wolves' defence.
Yeah, they were doing this last season as well, though. So I did have an eye on them at one point, breaking the Premier League record for the fewest goals in any game that they were that they played in. Just terrible, terrible entertainment all year round. Maka, the other kind of wild card in all this is, as Dave mentioned in the interview, they were likely to sign Diego Costa when I spoke to him. They have now signed Diego Costa, so he could be in line for a start. He's likely to be involved in some capacity at the weekend. Does that make them a bit more dangerous?
He's not going to start, is he? He's not going to be match fit, so he's probably on the bench. So, yeah, I'd like us to be two goals in front in the last 20 minutes, because... The last thing we want is it being 0-0 or us 1-0 up and then them throwing him on for the last 20 minutes and the crowd will be going mental and then you just all, anything could happen. But I think I'm more confident than you for the weekend. I just think we'll just be better than them.
Yeah, I think doing podcasts like this actually has made me overestimate every opposition ever. So I can, if we could have been playing like Dagenham and Redbridge this weekend, I'd be going, well, you know, they've had a good start. Yeah, they've had a good start to the season.
I've got a young lad from Altrincham who's just joined.
Yeah, so you never know. I'm going to run through some quick fire options, Paul. Given that the international break's coming up, there's obviously plenty of players who'll be playing in that, and there'll be some that get a rest. Given that we haven't really seen much of Alvarez, would you like to see him involved?
Oh, definitely. I think Haaland took the limelight because of how good he's been. But, I mean, Alvarez just looks unbelievable. You know, he's a perfect Pep player, isn't he? The way he chases down the ball, he can pass, he can shoot, he can defend as well and stop counter-attacks. He can play all the way across the front and attack in mid. So, yeah, love to see him play.
Yeah. How about Haaland, Mako? Is he going to need a rest at some point?
My head says yes. My heart, I don't want him to. I just want him to play every game.
Yeah.
Play every game,
score two. Yeah.
Yeah. I know that's not going to happen. But I don't know. Or does he? Or does he just keep playing him and just see what happens until he breaks? Then we stick him back in the lab and sort him out, and then that'll be all right.
Yeah. Download the new update and see how he is. How about the centre backs, Paul? Because I thought the bright sparks from the first hour or so against Dortmund was that both Ake and Akanji looked pretty good. So, if Diaz is available, Stones is obviously available. Don't know about Walker, so maybe Stones is needed at right back. What would you do?
I think keep the same back four. I think it worked. I don't think we're particularly vulnerable. There's a couple of, Dortmund sort of counted a couple of times, but I think we looked really strong. I think Akanji has settled in really well. I think Ake's brilliant one-on-one defensively. He wins a lot in the air. Cancelo usually attacks more and he comes backwards. So and Stone's obviously solid. So I'd keep the same back four if that falls fit.
Yeah, the only question I got then on top of that, Maka, would be maybe Gomez to left back, Cancelo to right back, so that Stones can go in the middle.
Possibly. I'm conflicted with Cancelo at left back. Because I love what he brings creatively, but when he dangles that left leg out when he's defending, he's just someone's running past him.
Yeah, penalty on the cards.
God, I know. But I'd have no problem with that. But I'd have no problem with both. But I'd probably go with what Paul says. I agree with that.
It's the Cancelo standing tackle, which either looks incredibly nonchalant and really good and it sends the player flying, or he just wipes them out. Yeah, or gets taken on completely.
Yeah, bypassed entirely.
The thing with Cancelo is, it's so entertaining to watch for so many different reasons, like per game, like it's but a really high level of performance. He'll just like hit an absolute wonderful outside of the foot pass, do loads of skill, or he'll just miss like a 5 yard sideways pass and create a counter attack and then moan everyone.
Yeah, or for no reason, just roll it to their centre forward in the middle of the in the centre circle. Yeah,
and then blame someone else.
Yeah, why have you done that? I don't know. Just fancy doing it.
But it's Hollywood entertainment.
Yeah. Right, charity bet time. I was correct for the Dortmund game on last week's podcast. That was an £85 win, and it takes the total for the season to £205. We're collecting for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're helping the Trussell Trust support people in food poverty in Manchester. William Hill is giving each of us a £10 correct score single on City's games. So we heard earlier on from Dave from Talking Wolves, he's going for a 1-1 draw. That is 9-1 if he's right, so £90 will go into the kitty if it finishes 1-1 on Saturday. Paul, what are you having?
I'm going to go 2-0 City.
2-0 City is 6-1 and £60 if you're right. Macca?
3-1 City.
Comfortable 3-1. Well, I'm assuming it'd be comfortable and they don't score like two stoppage time goals.
Last minute, that.
Yeah. if it finishes 3-1, that's 11-1 and £110 if you're right. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more on responsible gambling, take a look at begambleaware.org.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
Now then, it might feel like City are Champions League regulars these days, given they've qualified for the competition each season since 2011. But the club's relationship with European tournaments isn't that simple. City fan and author Simon Curtis has documented the whole thing from the club's baby steps onto the continent in the late 60s to their re-emergence in the early noughties. I've been speaking to him about the book called City in Europe and about City in European competition.
It goes back a lot longer than most people believe. To start with, so it's a long story. It's an interesting story. It's an in and out story. It's an up and down story. I mean, this is what we've always expected from City, isn't it? Disaster around every corner. I mean, it's not so frequently talked about these days, obviously, but it always used to be a speciality of the club to find a special way of failing, didn't it? And, we continued to do that in Europe for many years, and some would say we're still doing it. So it's a special area of the club which really still needs attending to, I suppose. You know, if you look at all the success over the last few years, it's the one bit that still needs adjusting, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to the start, because, I mean, when I was born and when I was growing up as a City fan, European competition was just not something that we were ever thought possible for City. So, kind of that phrase "terrorize Europe" was always kind of like it was a monkey on the back for us as fans, like growing up in the 80s and 90s. The attitude at the time when City first got into the European Cup was like City will do well here.
Well, that was Malcolm Allison all over, wasn't it? He was full of bravado, and to some extent, rightly so. He had a great squad of players, and he had Joe Mercer backing him up. What could go wrong? You know, they'd already tasted success, so. Their tails were up, if you like, and he immediately regretted that quote, but he had to live with it, obviously. But within a year, they had kind of terrorised Europe. You know, winning a European trophy in those days didn't take quite what it does these days. It was only 4 or 5 rounds and you're in the final already, and if you're lucky, you get some pretty duff opponents along the way as well. But yes, it was a typical Malcolm Allison start to the roller coaster, if you like. But again, it fits City. City have always had their mavericks and their loudmouths and their tricksters and their jesters and their rascals, haven't they? So Allison started the ball rolling, really, with that quote.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Cup Winners' Cup success. I guess that's a little bit kind of difficult for younger fans to kind of process what that means. But the Cup Winners Cup was regarded as a good trophy to win, wasn't it? It wasn't like winning the Europa Conference League at this stage as the third level of European competition. It was a major trophy.
It was football bank. So these days has condemned things like the Conference League, so that, you know, we joke about Thursday evening football and all the rest of it, and if you're not in the Champions League, you're a bit of a joke. But in those days, you know, getting into Europe was quite a thing. There were three trophies, obviously, European Cup, UEFA Cup as it was, and the Cup Winners' Cup. And the Cup Winners' Cup was the quirky one, if you want, because it was the previous season's National Cup winners, which meant, you know, it might be a surprise entrant. City were in a flush of good health at that time, so they won everything. But, you know, it might quite easily have been, and was in England's case, West Ham or Sunderland, who also won the Cup in the 70s and 80s, going into Europe on England's behalf. You know, so you could get all sorts of people as strange opponents in the Cup Winners' Cup, but it didn't feel at the time like a lesser competition. It was just slightly different.
Yeah. How long was it for City, do you think, that as the years went by without European football, how long was it before the realisation set in that European football was a long way off?
Well, I mean, it came to a grinding halt in 1979, and I hadn't seen City in Europe then, not in the flesh, but I was aware that this was becoming a regular thing. You know, in the mid and late 70s, we're in the UEFA Cup four or five times. In that final UEFA Cup season, 78-79, we got through to the quarterfinal, even with a badly slumping side that season. And it just felt like another of those things that would be a regular occurrence, you know, just like City being in the top flight. I knew nothing other than City in the top flight until suddenly in 1983, we were relegated. And even that season, relegated on the last day of the season with 4 minutes to go. That was the first time we'd gone into the bottom three. It was just surreal. So suddenly having top flight football removed, having had European football removed, you thought, oh, well, this is a new thing. You know, this is the new City. And we'll go with the flow, and it was good fun, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody could have forecast that it would be 2003 before City got another sniff of Europe, which is a ridiculously long time.
Yeah, I remember, being in an exam at school when one of the teachers who was a City fan knew all the City fans while the UEFA Cup draw was going on. And like, just, you know, in that way in school exams, you stick your hand up, can I have a bit more paper, can I have like this? He kind of give that knowing look to say the draw's been done. So you'd stick your hand up and he'd wander over and just say, by the way, we're going to Wales. It just, like, after that all that brilliant build up, it's just Wales, isn't it?
Absolutely brilliant. And the Welsh manager just hit it on the head when he said, you know, City have waited such a long time. It's such a shame that having waited for 25 years or whatever it was, they're going to exit the tournament straight away in Wales. Fantastic. Yeah. But it would have been typical, wouldn't it? What a start that was. That season, in fact, we managed to get Lokeren, which was a sort of half normal side, although I think they were bottom of the Belgian league when we played them. But then we went out to the very unlikely opponent of Grocklin, or Disco Bolia, as they were called at the time, in a park covered in snow in some godforsaken bit of eastern Poland in front of 5,000 people. So it was almost as bad as going out to Total Network Solutions, in fact, in the end.
I mean, it's interesting, the qualification side of things, because when you look at the early days, obviously City qualified by winning the league title. They qualified by winning the FA Cup. And then kind of like by the 2000s come along, you know, that first Kevin Keegan era in 2003, okay, they qualified for the Fair Play League. The next time, again, was the Fair Play League when they lost 8-1 at Middlesbrough and still somehow qualified for Europe.
Yes.
It kind of shows where City were at in the kind of noughties, that's as close as they were getting to success, isn't it?
Yeah, I remember Keegan at the time being, as he was wont to be, full of enthusiasm that we'd finally got into Europe again, and that he was at the helm when we did it. but when the realization dawned on him how we'd managed to get in, everyone was a tiny bit embarrassed, I think, really, because at least one of those two seasons you mentioned, Everton finished above us and really should have gone in on merit. We were lower in the table than them, but got in because we got fewer red and yellow cards, which is a little bit ridiculous. And we did it twice, as you said. So, yeah, that was the sort of scrabbling to get back in that we had to be involved with until 2010-11 when we finished fifth and actually qualified properly.
Yeah, and of course, you know, in terms of managers and City in Europe, you have to say that City in recent years, starting off with Roberto Mancini getting them into the Champions League, and then Pellegrini getting them into the knockouts, and then Guardiola getting them to the final. The progression has been there, hasn't it? And so, how do you rank the City managers for their input in terms of the City in Europe story? Because obviously, it all starts back with Joe Mercer and Malcolm Allison.
It does, yeah. In modern terms, I have a soft spot for Mancini, I must admit, because he took City into the Champions League for the first time. Tough days, those first two seasons, difficult groups to get out of, which we didn't get out of. But still, you know, that was a tough testing ground for the club, I think. And we got our backside slapped a few times, but it was interesting. It was our first attempt at playing the Bayern Munichs and the big boys, Barcelona. So I have a soft spot for Mancini, I must admit. But you're right, there has been an obvious procession each time. You know, Pellegrini took us on and managed to get us out of the groups. Although his final legacy, I think, was a bit of a disappointment in that getting to the semi against Real Madrid, we really didn't do ourselves justice in those two games. Very flat performances, especially the second leg in Madrid. I was there for that, and it was just, I don't know, it was just so flat. You know, it needed a last hurrah. It only needed a goal, and the whole thing was back on edge, you know, and we didn't look like we'd been told to do that. So that was a bit of a shame. Obviously, since Guardiola's been in charge, things have moved on very smoothly to a completely different level. City are now seen as obvious contenders each year as the competition starts, and rightly so. But, you know, back to the old story, we have to come good on that, I think.
Yeah, you mention in the book that you can kind of split City fans into three kind of portions. The ones who believe it's cursed and they'll never win anything in Europe. The ones who believe it's inevitable. It's, you know, with the resources they've got and the manager they've got and the players they've got, it is inevitable that they'll win it eventually. And the others who I would class myself in, I don't really care whether they win it or not, as long as they win the domestic stuff. So where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I used to be in one group and now I'm in another, I think. You know, I always used to think we were cursed and that nothing would go right. I've seen so many disasters down the years, but that old, you know, I'm even loath to call it typical City because it almost doesn't exist anymore. You know, even our typical City moments these days, you know, the Villa game last season, the QPR game, on the edge of disaster, we're now pulling it round each time. So I would say there's nothing really inevitable in football, I guess, but it's as near to a certainty as you can get that City will, within 3 or 4 years, I think, probably get their hands on this thing. If they don't, then it's going to make for an interesting story because, you know, the way we've missed out on it so far in recent years is already pretty bizarre. So I think it would need a continuation of some pretty bizarre occurrences to stop a team like City finally getting there.
Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure. Where can people buy the book if they want to read some more?
Yeah, it's in the club shop. And if you miss out on that, then obviously Watersons in town have got plenty of copies as well.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter @Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Simon Curtis talking about his new book. Let's finish with some listener questions. Get them in for next week on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email through the website as well, bluemoonpodcast.com. That's how Anna has got in touch. We were going to do this one on last week's show, but we ran out of time. And then with the game being cancelled at the weekend, it's given us the perfect opportunity to return to it. So Anna says, I came away from the Villa game pretty disappointed, if I'm honest. I know we've had a good start to the season, but we've got away with dropping points by other teams not capitalising. I know Pep's teams can take a short while to click going into a season, but it feels like a slowish start despite being second. With the World Cup in the middle of the season, it feels like a season of two halves, and we don't know how that will affect City's momentum. How important is it to get into rhythm quickly this season, and what do you think our expectations should be for where we are when we pause? So just to kind of give you an idea of where City could be, at the moment they're second in the table, they're a point off the top, they've got 14 points, Arsenal have got 15. Now, because of rearranged games and because of games being cancelled, the games that City have got before the World Cup are Wolves away, United at home, Southampton at home, Liverpool away, Brighton at home, Leicester away, Fulham at home, and then Brentford at home. There's a maximum of 24 points available. They could get to 38 points before the World Cup. Maka, what's your gut instinct for this? Where do you think we should be aiming to be by the time the World Cup comes along in terms of points?
Well, they're all winnable, aren't they? I mean, even the Liverpool one, because other things come into the dark arts come into play when you go to Anfield. But so I'd take a point at Anfield. But all of those are very, very, very winnable. So yeah, I think we've just got to aim for that. But I mean, it is quite strange though, because I mean, put yourself in the place of some of these players who are going to the World Cup a few weeks before. There's a 50-50 there. Are you really going to throw yourself in there if you're feeling a bit of your hamstring? And it's just all a bit, it's all a bit strange. And then going back to when they come back, people are going to be injured, people are going to be knackered. It's just going to be skewed. I think it's just going to skew the whole season, to be honest.
Yeah, I did look when I looked at the fixtures originally, Paul. There was an Arsenal game in there as well, where I thought that'll be tricky given how they've started the season. Obviously, looking at Liverpool, thinking that's tricky. Mm. We've already mentioned my thoughts on the Wolves game this weekend that I think could be tricky. The Manchester Derby is one of those where you go, okay, United are crap, but then every now and then they pull out a result, and that's annoying. Brighton I had down as a tricky game, but then you know the manager's gone off to Chelsea, so we don't know what they're going to be like. Maybe we should be a bit more optimistic than I am being right now.
I think so. I mean, if we get 38 points, that keeps us out of the relegation zone, doesn't it? Hopefully, at the end of the season. So just got to think, I'll get to that 38,
yeah.
40 point
mark. Get safe, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. The first few games, I was a bit concerned. Something wasn't quite clicking. The Aston Villa game was very strange. But our main competitors, you know, Arsenal, it's a big step up for them from where they were in the previous season. Can they maintain it? City have kind of never really had that big dip. They've kind of sustained the level throughout the season and gone on runs. But because Liverpool have been quite poor, and I think we don't know what to expect of United yet, Chelsea have obviously had a change in manager, I think we're in quite a good position, really. I think it's only going to get better. We're only going to click a bit more. Bernardo is obviously staying, which is a big, big, big plus. You know, Phillips has looked good when he's come on, and then Haaland's obviously made a massive difference. Alvarez has slotted in. We've changed a lot of key players from the first sort of 13, 14 people, players that play in each game. And I think it's been about as seamless as it can be, I think, for us to be second by a point.
Yeah, I mean, with the Villa and Newcastle games, again, I'm fairly relaxed about it. I think it was just one of those. I mean, with the Villa one, I think, 5:30 kickoff on a Saturday, they were all up for it, the fans, and it just kind of seemed to snowball. Don't get me wrong, we should have killed the game off, but it just snowballed, and you knew they were going to score. It just felt like one of those games where they're going to score, but and it was what it was. With Newcastle, similar, the fans were all over us. It was just all against us, and it was building and building and building, and I took a massive positive from that. Then we actually came away with something from that. So, yeah, I think I'm turning into some kind of happy clapper.
we've broken you, Macca.
I know, yeah. But, let's put it this way. I've not seen anything this season yet that would really, really worry me.
Yeah, I think
a lot more positives.
And I think, as Paul said, the fact that you would have said before a ball was kicked this season, Liverpool would be City's main title rivals. The fact that they've had a really bad start to the season and are playing catch up. You know, United are a new kind of entity there. I can't see them being in the title race by the end of the season. If it is, you know, the top three currently, Arsenal, City, Spurs, if it is those three kind of going towards it towards the end of the season, then there's only the one team that's got the experience there. So I think that'll be a really key factor.
Well, it's massive as well. The Arteta at United, I mean, that just shows you how good Guardiola is because, and I don't understand how somebody who's actually kind of studied, in inverted commas, under Guardiola did what he did. They went 2-1 down. They were the best team. They were playing well. There was 20 minutes left. And he's just abandoned everything and basically just thrown a load of attackers on. And he was like, no, just keep playing. I've faith in it and just keep going. And that, so yeah, I've actually no problem with that. They'll fold. Spurs could be interested. They're decent.
Yeah.
And to be fair, United could be interested. You never know. But yeah. I can't see it. But it's always going to be Liverpool. It's always going to be Liverpool at the moment. And they're miles off.
Yeah.
If City's maintaining that sort of 93 plus points type tally, I don't know who's making that step up in golf out of anyone that's not Liverpool.
Yeah.
Well, especially if more people are taking points off each other as well.
Yeah, that'll absolutely help as well, won't it? Yeah. Right, well, that brings us to an end for this week's Blue Moon podcast. I'm David Mooney. Thanks to Paul Atherton.
Cheers, Moons.
And to Macca.
Cheers, Moons.
Join me again next week to review the game at Molineux. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
That commentary is definitely, then that commentary from Clive Tilsley, that's like the soundtrack of my teenage years. even now, you know, I can still remember it. Palace Day, full stretch, missed it, Oldfield 1-0. And obviously the last one as well, which was, you know, iconic commentary, I suppose, for City fans for the Hinchcliffe bullet header.
Yeah, chance at the far post. That's the line, isn't
early
it?
Early cross, chance at the far post. Hinchcliffe, that's just marvellous stuff. Yeah. Oh, hold on. Got a contributor in the form of my husband walking past. He remembers it as well very distinctly. So it was, what a fantastic day for City fans. And I remember, and again, you're probably too young for this, but older fans will remember, I recorded it on kickoff. And then on the video cassette, if you didn't want anybody to tape over that tape.
You used to push the thing in. Yeah.
Yes. VHS cassettes, you could push it and then nobody would record over it. And that was a common threat in our house, that somebody would just go, oh, this is on, I'll just select any tape and put it in and record it. But yeah, I actually adjusted the cassette so nobody could tape over it.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.